My name is Anisha Bora. I'm 19 years old. Today is November 19th, 2018, and I'm speaking with Santino Bora, who is my dad. We are recording this interview in Florence, Alabama. Can you tell me what it felt like when you were first sworn in as a citizen?
Oh, it was like removing a huge wall. Felt like a lot of the little things that come in the way when you're not a citizen was gone, just like that. So it felt good to be free and to realize that you have the same rights and responsibilities as any other American citizen.
But like, what are some of the things that were in the way that you felt like were removed?
Well, you know, when you have a green card, you can also do the same things, but becoming an American citizen is like taking the next step from the green card and making almost like a full 100% commitment to this country.
What was the hardest thing to adjust to in this country?
The roadway system. You drive on the wrong side of the street. If you're coming from India, if you're driving on the right side of the street, you're going to be in a lot of trouble, you know. So that was one adjustment that you had to make. And when I first came here, I of course came to Fargo, North Dakota from Delhi. And Delhi was about, 100 degrees. When I came to Fargo, North Dakota, it was about 60 plus. So big adjustment in terms of temperature. Never had seen snow. I had seen snow, but, you know, just for a couple of days. But then when snow sets in Fargo, North Dakota, it stays there for about 6 months. So that was kind of a little unusual.
Yeah. And you had to buy winter clothes for the first time.
Yes, never ever thought about winter clothes. And the first time when I went to look for an apartment for myself, I was surprised that no one is home at 10 o'clock in the morning because everyone goes to work. In India, you'd always find somebody in the house. So that was, whoa, what's going on? How come nobody is opening the doors or anything like that, you know? Then you realize, everybody's working. That's why no one's home.
Yeah.
Oh, you want to know something else?
Yeah.
I never cooked in my life. See, these are small little adjustments. In fact, when I first came in, I was staying with a couple of other Indian students. And they told me that, let's go to Kmart. I said, okay. Any reason as to why we need to go to Kmart? Oh, he says, it's a huge department store. You like it. I said, okay, I like it. That's good. They said, plus, they told me that I'll need a few things. I said, what things? How do you know what I need? He said, well, we know you don't have any cooking utensils. I said, yeah, I don't. And they said, how are you going to eat? Never even thought about that. Because till that point in time, I lived in dorms where food, breakfast, lunch, dinner, everything was taken care of. And if you're hungry, you need a snack, you go just outside. There are shopkeepers, there are small little cafes, kind of a deal.
Yeah.
And those are open literally, 24 hours a day. So, you can always grab something. So we never cooked in my life. So the first time I cooked, I picked up the phone, which is very expensive, just to know how to make rice. I was on the phone for a friend of mine. I was on the phone for about 10 minutes, which probably cost me about maybe $5-6 at that point in time.
What, you couldn't Google it?
There was no Google. This was 1985. Google was not even born then. There were no smartphones. Smart Alec.
What was your first day in the U.S. like?
Very tired, very hungry. Because I flew out from Delhi on a KLM flight to New York. And food was not all that great because in India we are used to eating so much spicy food and stuff like that. So on the flight they gave us the chicken and rice, but the chicken was almost like plastic. No taste, just rubbery.
Yeah.
So you wondered what's going on, So I landed up in JFK, then I called up a friend of mine and said, hey, I'm here, you have to come and pick me up. Of course, my friend was surprised because I had not let him know I was coming. And my stuff had not arrived, my luggage had not arrived. And so I talked to the guys who were, out there, porters essentially, saying that, hey, I need to make a phone call. Can you show me how? So I had a few dollar bills in my pocket. They said, that's not going to work. They put those dollar bills into the machine, got the quarters out, and they helped me make my first phone call to let my friend know that I'm coming, come and pick me up from the airport. So by the time the luggage came, he also came. And so we took a cab from there to his house and then went out to someone's house for dinner. So it's a very long, tiring flight and a long, long day.
But you had, so you knew someone already?
Yes, I knew someone already. Nice. Yeah. Yeah.
So like this kind of leads into this question. Did anyone help you when you first came to this country? And have you helped anyone since you've been here?
One thing, I've helped a lot of people. you know, I've been in this country now how many years? It's almost like 33 years. Mm-hmm. So it's most of my life I've been in this country now. Yes, I've helped a lot of people. I can remember a lot of stories that I can share with you. For example, one of our students supposedly had cancer. And that was, of course, a shock. One of our students, meaning an Indian student, who was by here all by himself. And when you have some devastating news like that, you don't know how to cope with it. So we were his first kind of, you know, point of contact in terms of how to deal with this issue. That was one incident. Another incident was when of our students from Nepal died, you know, and his father came over. So I had the responsibility of dealing with him, and that was a very difficult moment for him because I had never dealt with a situation like that before.
What are your most vivid memories of school?
Where?
Like, it can be whatever you want, like elementary school or like college.
Oh, in college. It's very simple. I was in Hindu College, Delhi University.
Yeah.
And right from day one, from as long as I can remember, I was always involved in, you can call it social service, you can call it politics, you can call it many different ways, but the whole, everything's driven by the fact that you put yourself in a position whereby you can help people. Mm-hmm. You don't necessarily seek those out, it comes your way and you grab it. So coming to Delhi was a big challenge because I was about, 2,000 miles away from home, did not know anybody in that huge city. And especially at Hindu College where I was, it's an elite college in Delhi University. People say it's the second best college. The first, they say, is St. Stephen's. But I'm okay with it, you know. And I jumped into politics right from day one. Although I did not speak the local language, which put me at a distinct disadvantage. Mm-hmm. I did not have any local connections. I didn't know anybody. All of the people that I ran against in elections were all local people. People who had gone to school there, they knew a lot of people, they knew how the system worked, they knew how to talk.
Yeah.
I didn't know any of those things. I had to learn all of those things.
Yeah. But like, what about a specific memory that really stands out to you from there?
Oh, I was kidnapped. It's as simple as that. Student politics in India, especially in Delhi, is at a very different level. Mm. So they wanted me to vote for a certain candidate. And the elections are kind of a little crazy in the way those elections are conducted. Mm-hmm. So it's like, you know, first preference vote, second preference vote, third preference, and you get 11 first preference votes, you win. Mm. So what the way the system worked was this way. They would pick up 11 guys like us who are presidents of the college, and there's another thing called central counselor. Mm-hmm. They'd pick up 11 people, and then they'd keep us, wine us, dine us, feed us, whatever, you know. And then on the day of the voting, we would be dropped off right in front of the polling booth. Mm-hmm. You'd get down, vote, and when you go out from the other side, the van is waiting for you. Mm-hmm. So in other words, if you're 11 people walking in, you better get 11 votes. Mm. See?
But how do they control only 11 people?
You get, it's weighted differently. First preference, you get more weights, you know? So, and they'll say, these are the people that you have to vote for. Mm-hmm. So fortunately, although I was kidnapped to go and meet their top leader, I was able to...
Who is there?
it's between, like, you know, there are two parties in India, Congress and the BJP, just like the Republicans and the Democrats out here. So the somebody belonging to the Congress party had picked me up. So, and they said that this is who you have to vote for. But I also had friends who belonged to that party. And I told them that I had already committed myself to this other guy from their party. So then they didn't know what to do with me. Because if I go with them, that means that other guy is not going to get my vote and they will get mad with them. So they let me off. But, you know, it's a very weird system. They came to pick me up from my dorm, which was around 7:30, which is not dark, you know, you know. But everyone knows, you know, we are about 250 kids who live in a dorm. Everyone knows that this is what happens. People will come talk to you sometime, you know, they'll just pick you up and you go with them. So, and they said that we want you to come with me, with us. And I said, listen, if I go with you now, my friends are going to ask me, am I going on my own will? You know, I can say yes or I can say no. And if I do say no, a fight will break out. And it's not something that we want. They said, what should we do? I said, come back later at night. So they said, are you going to be there? I said, yeah, I'll be there. Don't worry about it. So they came at 1 o'clock to pick me up, 1 a.m. in the morning. And we were stuffed into a car. And, you know, they use all kinds of scare tactics that they would sit down in the car and take out their guns and put it on the dashboard and stuff like that. So, you know, those are the different types of tactics that they use to kind of, you know, scare you, scare tactics, as they call it. But they appreciated, those guys who took me, they said they appreciated the fact that when I said 1 o'clock, I was there for them. They said 90% of the time, those guys would run away. You know, when they say come at 1 o'clock, they never come. I mean, people disappear.
Yeah.
You know.
What was your relationship like with your parents?
Well, you know, my father was also very involved. When he managed a tea plantation so that he could do the things that he wanted to. He was more of a social activist. And you may not understand the term, but he was what you call a Gandhian. So he would always wear khadi dresses, you know, shirts, pajamas, vest, everything would have to be khadi. And that was rough clothing, so it had to be ironed, it had to be pressed properly, otherwise you cannot wear it. And so so he was busy with his thing, and my mom was busy taking care of the household, and I was busy doing my own thing, you know. So
you weren't very close to them?
No, I knew what my father was doing. I would always go with him. And when you go out for, I've been electioneering from very little, going on election campaigns to meetings and rallies and all of that. So that was nothing new for me.
Yeah. And so were you close with your siblings?
No, not really. Because when I was 15, I left home when I was 15.
Yeah.
So, you know, and my youngest brother was then 13 at that point in time. So not very close at all. So after, you know, and then I came to this country. So the distance made it almost impossible to kind of, you know, be close. In fact, when my younger brother passed away, which was in 1993, and when someone read his obituary, I felt like that was a stranger. That was not the brother I had known, you know. So
how old was he the last time you had seen him?
Oh, it was probably, but I had not seen him for about 7 years, 7.5 years, because I had not gone to India for 7.5 years. So
how did you meet mom?
Oh, I met mom because she came to see me in Florence, Alabama. I went to pick her up. She was also in Delhi University.
There's no way. You met her before you came to the States.
Delhi University. Okay. You know, it was just there, kind of, you know.
What do you mean?
I mean, you know, like the other day you had a party at Sarah's house. And there were 20 people. People like, that's how you meet people.
But there was no specific...
No, nothing specific.
But There's no weird. How did you meet?
Well, then we met here over on the phone. That's how we first met, and then we talked and this and that. That's how it all started.
Okay. Tell me a favorite memory of me.
A favorite memory of you. Mm-hmm. All right. I would. A favorite memory of me would be to rub her back and put her to sleep.
That seems like it would be more annoying.
No, it is not annoying. And you would not sleep, and I rub your back, and you'd go off to sleep. I had to do that with your brother, too.
Yeah. For how many years?
For a very long time, until you guys said no. Until you guys felt like you're too old to be rubbed by your dad to fall asleep. Felt like that was not right. And said, no, we don't want that anymore.
Probably to middle school.
Yeah.
Can you tell me about one or two people who've been the biggest influences on your life?
There are several people. One I can say was Dr. Kiran Seth, who's a Padma Shri, which is like the Presidential Medal of Honor in India. Mm-hmm. And he had a PhD in operations research from sunny Buffalo or someplace maybe about 50 years back. Mm-hmm. So he went to one of those very prestigious schools in India, a technical school, mm-hmm. called Indian Institute of Technology in Kanpur. Mm-hmm. And he was a part of what he called a Western music band. So, you know, he'd play all kind of rock and roll music and this and that. So that was his life mm-hmm. in India. But when he came to do his doctorate, he was still into Western music. And one day his roommate wanted him to kind of, you know, go over to an Indian classical musical event. He said, no, I don't follow that. I don't need to go. But he said, come on, I'm your roommate. I'm asking you, can't you do this for me? Mm-hmm. I said, okay. He went and his whole life literally changed from that point onwards. Mm-hmm. He started to read up more and he saw what Eastern music was all about. Mm-hmm. And he literally dedicated his life for the promotion of that, of Indian classical music. He went back to India and he started a group called Society for Promotion of Indian Classical Music and Culture Amongst Youth. Mm-hmm. He was taken aback by the fact that how much the youth had embraced Western music. Mm-hmm. And he was wondering why, you know, we have such a rich tradition of our music, mm-hmm. and why is it that the youth embraces Western music. Mm-hmm. So he followed all of the Indian classical kings and queens, whatever you call it, maestros, mm-hmm. and organized events for them, organized events for students. He would call it Baithak. Baithak means, you know, like you would more have a informal conversation. Mm-hmm. When they're playing a musical instrument or seeing something, they have to explain why they're playing it, what is the root of that tune, mm-hmm. where did it come from. So it was an ongoing conversation. This is, you know, all happening while I am a student at Delhi University at Hindu mm-hmm. College. So I was not too much into any kind of music, mm-hmm. to tell you honestly. So when I became the president of my college, you have to make a decision. And I had made a decision that I was going to have all night Western music. Mm-hmm. Bands would come in and play for all night. Mm-hmm. So one day, someone told me that, you know, Kiran wants to talk to you. I said, sure, I can talk to him. Mm-hmm. So we sat down for a very long time. And he said, Shantanu, what do you want in life? I said, no, why do you ask that question? Mm-hmm. He said, no, I'm not sorry. Let me take it back. He said, no, why do you want to have Western classical music all night? Mm-hmm. Can you paint a picture of what it will look like when you have Western musical evening or night, all night? Mm-hmm. So we said, yes, there will be bonfires. Mm-hmm. People will be drinking. People will be dancing. Mm-hmm. And people will be making not so nice, thoughtful comments about the girls and this and that. Mm-hmm. And they most likely would be not only just smoking regular cigarettes, but mm-hmm. weed and all of that kind of stuff. And that would be kind of the prevalent thing, mm-hmm. you know. And he said, now I want you to take a quick, you know, 30-second pause mm-hmm. and think about what would happen in an Eastern musical evening. So I said, well, you know, it'll be quiet.
Mm-hmm.
People will be in their best behavior.
Mm-hmm.
People will be dressed in traditional Indian clothes. People would not be smoking.
Mm-hmm.
People would be treating each other with respect.
Mm-hmm.
So then he asked me, what kind of society would you like? You know, so I said, well, it is obvious that I'd like to see this kind of society, mm-hmm. which was kind of he associated with the Eastern music.
Mm-hmm.
Then he said, why don't you do something about it? I said, what do you want me to do? He said, why have Western musical night? Have an Eastern musical night? I said, well, you know what? I had already made arrangements for the Western classical, so I know what needs to happen.
Mm-hmm.
If I want to switch gears, I would not know what to do.
Mm-hmm.
He said, don't worry about that part. I can take care of that part.
Mm-hmm.
You tell me you want to move from a Western to an Eastern,
mm-hmm.
I'll take care of everything. I said, okay, if that's what you're telling me, then I don't mind.
Mm-hmm.
He said, okay. And we'll come up with a budget. This is how much is it going to cost. You tell me, and we'll take it from there. He gave me a budget. I okayed it.
Mm-hmm.
And we went from there. So, and the amount of respect that he has for these Indian classical musical gurus mm-hmm. is amazing. Now think about it. This guy is a PhD from the US in operations research.
Mm-hmm.
And this Pandit Jasraj is probably, I don't even know if he ever went to school or not, because they always go to the musical type of schools mm-hmm. and stuff like that. So I went to one of his concerts, and this guy comes out of his car, just getting out of his car, and my friend or my mentor, Kiran Seth, he kind of lies down on the road, literally,
mm-hmm.
completely flat on the ground to touch his feet as a sign of paying respect to him.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't expect that.
Yeah.
So I thought, you know, so I learned a lot of things.
Yeah. And like, and how did that event end up turning out?
Oh, that event, it was a lot of work for me.
Mm-hmm.
Like, just to give an idea, at 2:30 in the morning, certain vocalist,
mm-hmm.
They wanted what do you call warm milk with almonds and all of that.
They're such drama queens.
Yeah, because you know the vocal cords. Yeah. Because it's 2:00 in the morning, yeah. You're sleeping. You have to. Yeah, they've obviously taken a nap.
Yeah.
You know, to come and perform.
Mm-hmm.
So they have to wake those vocal cords up mm-hmm. and so on and so forth. So we had to have about 2 or 3 cars running mm-hmm. all the time to pick up an artist,
mm-hmm.
Bring them. Take them back, you know,
mm-hmm.
and to manage all of these things.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, it was exactly like we had envisioned, that people, although not everyone was wearing Indian clothes,
mm-hmm.
but they were wearing all like, you know, Sunday best clothes,
mm-hmm.
and they were in their best behavior. They treated mm-hmm. each other with respect, and it was a very quiet, controlled evening.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in the Western music, I wouldn't be surprised if somebody would get stabbed.
Mm-hmm.
Because things just go out of control when people are drinking
mm-hmm.
and smoking, anything could happen type of a deal.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously there would be fights that would break out during those events,
yeah.
Western music. But with the Eastern thing, all night, nothing happened.
So when was the last time you saw,
like, Kiran?
Yeah.
Oh, it's been a while now. Maybe 20 years, 25 years.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't seen him.
Where is he now?
He's in Delhi. He's retired. He's no longer teaching, but he's still promoting that classical music group.
How come you didn't see him when you went 2 weeks ago?
I didn't have his number.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to plan things in India, in
yeah.
Delhi, because it's like an hour and a half to go there.
Mm-hmm.
And the person is not there, mm-hmm. hour and a half coming back, so you've lost 3 hours.
Yeah.
So, you know, so I had about 2 or 3 days. And I couldn't, if I had his number, if I would have talked to him, mm-hmm. I would have gone to see him.
Yeah.
But I made a half-hearted attempt. I sent him a message on Facebook. I don't even know if he checks Facebook or
yeah.
not, you know, so.
Yeah.
Plus the window was too narrow.
Too short,
too
yeah.
Too short.
But anyone yeah. else?
Oh, there was another guy. His name is Dr. Hemant Laskar.
Mm-hmm.
But can I go back to the first guy?
Yeah.
You know, one of the things that he did for me was he knew I didn't like classical music or
yeah.
I, you know, didn't have much of an appreciation for classical music.
Mm-hmm.
So he would invite me to go and speak in different colleges with him,
mm-hmm.
not by myself,
yeah.
to talk about the merits of Eastern music. And I don't remember exactly what I had talked about.
Yeah.
But the vision of Western music night and Eastern music, that's something
mm-hmm.
that will stick with me. So he gave me an opportunity to lead an event to organize what he called you may not be familiar with it. It's called non-aligned countries. Mm-hmm. Essentially, you know, you had the U.S. and you had the Russians, right? Mm-hmm. And the Soviet bloc.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a group of countries that were not aligned.
Mm-hmm.
Yugoslavia with Marshal Tito and so on and so forth. They were non-aligned. That's what they call it. So there are about 25, 30 countries like that. Some of them are like Commonwealth countries, you know. So he gave me the opportunity to lead and organize an event called, and I named the event Non-Aligned Meet Youth Festival, NAMI Fest, I call it. I worked out all the details for all the events, but before I could see that happen, I had to leave to come to this country. That would probably be my biggest regret, because that would have put me on the national stage.
So you did all the background work?
The programming part of it, you know. All because this was an Indian government event.
Yeah.
So all the countries were contacted by the government.
Mm-hmm.
And all the universities in India
would be
mandatory for them to attend the event.
Uh-huh.
Because, you know, everybody gets grant funding from the U.S. Department of Education. So when they put a mandate out, you have to respond. In India, it's like that. It's here, you can get by.
Yeah.
In India, if they give a mandate saying that you have to do this, you have to do it. So that was a mandate that would have put me in the front of 5,000-10,000 people to manage this event.
Did it end up happening? Or?
Yes, it ended up happening about a year later. And when I saw the program, I felt what you call goosebumps. Because I know what I missed.
Yeah. But why did you have to leave?
I came to this country.
Yeah.
I got my visa.
Yeah.
So that's why I came. Otherwise, I would have done that.
But why did you want to leave?
Why did I want to leave? I wasn't really I wasn't very keen on coming to the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
I was more keen on becoming a politician.
Mm-hmm.
That's where my life was headed.
Yeah.
But looking back, you know, as a student, I was able to achieve about 90%.
Mm-hmm.
of what a student can do. I just could not make it to the next level in the Delhi University is because you had to belong to either, you had to be either like a Democrat or a Republican.
Like BJP.
Or the Congress.
Uh-huh.
Congress, they had a very bad reputation in India, in Assam, in my part of the world.
Yeah.
And BJP was non-existent in my part of the world. This is 1984, 1985. They were not there. So I from a philosophical standpoint, I was not going to go myself willingly with Congress because I know some of the things that they had done, which I completely kind of disagreed.
Yeah.
So I was, you see, I didn't know where to go. I was at a crossroads. So when this opportunity came along, I said, let me go see the world. Maybe I'll learn something. That's why I came.
That's nice. Can you tell me about one of the most difficult moments in your life?
One of the most difficult moments in my life would be, I think, when my brother passed away. That was, I was in Florence, Alabama. I'd just spoken with, I don't even know. Yeah, we were not even married. I had, you know, spoken with your mom and I don't know if a call came in or something like that. But anyway, we hung up and a call came in. And my mom was not doing all that great. You know, from a health perspective, we knew she had diabetes and stuff like that. The moment I picked up the phone, I did get a sense that something terrible had happened. So my first thing was, okay, something happened to my mom. So somebody else, from a neighbor, is at the other end of the line. And he says, you know, I have some bad news. I said, something happened to my mom? He said, no. Nothing happened to my dad? I said, no. Then I said, what happened? He said, your brother passed away. So when I heard that news, now you got to understand, I had not seen him for 7.5 years or 7 years at that point.
Yeah.
You know, it's death is a very kind of a, it has its own sets of what you call, takes you down a big black hole, just like that, and you feel like, oh wow, what's happening? You're completely overtaken by the emotion of that thing. So that was something very weird, in a way that, yeah, because I never experienced anyone dying on me. That mm-hmm. was the first time that had happened.
Yeah.
And it's a very weird feeling.
So.
But I also understand that in order to go through life, that's a part of the journey. It's part of the journey. You can't mm-hmm. avoid it. Even you have to go through it also.
Like, who is around you that you...
Nobody. And then that night...
Like, mom wasn't here.
No, she was in Toronto.
Mm-hmm. So what did you do that day?
Oh, I didn't do anything. It was evening. That's it. I went to sleep. Went to work the next day. Then some of my friends came over that weekend from Nashville. No, from Carbondale. Manish Kohli, Sunil Gupta, and some of them came over. Then we went to the temple in Nashville. We did some prayer. Mm-hmm. That's about it. Yeah.
It says, of the people you've lost in your life, who do you miss the most, and what is it about them that you miss?
Well, people who died?
Mm-hmm.
Probably my dad, because I knew he was a good man. He was not after money. He was after, if he could help someone, he could. But I think, so that put him at a very different level. He was not aggressive. He was not hungry for power.
Mm-hmm.
He was in a position where he could have done a lot of things for himself. He didn't do that. So sometimes you regret those moments, because anytime those opportunities come along, you have to learn how to grab it, because it doesn't come knocking every day.
Mm-hmm.
But for the greater good, you know, he'd give up on those opportunities. So that hurt him a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, sometimes when he helped some people, the same people would not turn around to help him,
mm-hmm.
you see. But he was a good man.
But what is it specifically that you missed?
Oh, his desire. He was like someone managed everything very well. You know, mm-hmm. I should not say very well. But the political part, I mean, people from our neighbor, our village, our house would always be full of people. People wanting to get something done. Somebody wanted a job, that needed a letter of recommendation, or they wanted my dad to put in a good word for them.
Mm-hmm.
Or someone was needed permission from the government to open up a shop, and they were getting stuck and no one was willing to talk to them,
mm-hmm.
and things like that. You know, so... or somebody needed some money,
mm-hmm.
you know, because their son had done well and they want to go and study at a college, they don't have money, what do you do?
Mm-hmm.
Someone is sick at the hospital,
mm-hmm.
they need money. So people came for all kinds of things. So, and he was able to handle all of that quite well.
Yeah.
You know.
Can you tell me one of your happiest memories?
My happiest moment? Maybe when I was elected president of my college,
mm-hmm.
that's probably one of the happiest moments, because I had not expected that.
Mm-hmm.
I did not expect to win the election, because I was an outsider.
Mm-hmm.
I did not speak the language, and I told you I didn't have the connections.
Mm-hmm.
Even people from my home state told me that, you know, we will vote for you, but it's not good. Why are you running?
Mm-hmm.
Stay away from it.
Mm-hmm.
But despite that, I felt the urge,
mm-hmm.
that I needed to do this for myself, not generally for myself, but
mm-hmm.
you know, I was looking at it and I see these guys who are wanting to become presidents of my college, and
mm-hmm.
I said, I know I can do better than that, so
yeah.
That's why I did it.
But so why do you think you were successful if you weren't set up to win?
I think people did vote for me because. Now you have to talk to some other people.
Mm.
But my perception is this. That it felt like this is some guy who is, yes, he's not polished, but you can trust him.
Mm-hmm.
He might be some guy who would be willing to fight for you.
Mm-hmm.
And if he says that he will do it, he will do it. The other guys were too slick,
mm-hmm.
you know, and they would know how to wiggle themselves out of that situation.
Mm-hmm.
But this guy, or me, they felt like they could trust me. That
mm-hmm.
was the only thing.
Mm-hmm.
That was the only thing I had going for myself.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense.
Because when you talk to politicians and stuff like student leaders, they talk a lot of big stuff, right? And I'll do this, I'll do that. I don't think I said anything very big.
Yeah.
You know, but I stuck to my message that, you know, we work together.
So if that was one of your happiest memories, but like, do you what do you feel like you're doing now that keeps you connected with what makes you happy?
Like in this past election.
Yeah.
We know that Democrats in this part of Alabama will have a tough time. But despite that, I went out on a limb, made a short video for one of the candidates, a Democratic candidate, who I felt was the better candidate. And I worked for some of the other candidates, took them around, introduced to a lot of people, and so on and so forth. So people, I put myself on the line saying that, yes, I'm not necessarily a Democrat, but I support these candidates because of who they are. So I've been following that path. And people ask me, are you going to run for something? I said, no, that's not for me.
Why?
Alabama is not the place for me to be thinking about running. If I was in New York or someplace, yes.
Yeah.
But not in Alabama.
Yeah. Can you tell me about some of the most important lessons you've learned in life?
In life? Trust. If you say something, you should try to deliver on that. Whether that is going to happen 100% or not, I'm not worried about that. But from within me, did I give it my 100%? I might have promised you something. I may not be able to deliver you that. But I need to feel happy with the fact that I promised you that, and I did my best to get that for you. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. So that's my biggest thing. That, you know, over time, that's who, or that's what should define who you are. That's one thing. And when you help people, do not expect them to help you in return. Help them, move on, don't look back.
And because it is Thanksgiving, what is something, well, like, what are you most grateful for?
Grateful for the family, I guess. I have a family. I've got you, I've got mom, I've got Rohit. So that's what you're thankful for. And the fact that you are still healthy, still have a passion for teaching, still have a passion to do something good for society. And that's what I'm thankful for, you know.
Yeah. Well, that's all. Thank you very much for letting me interview you.
Alrighty. Hopefully this will be of some use.